Last year, Canada was ravaged by some of their worst wildfires on record. Thick smoke from the Canadian wildfires wafted down and blanketed a broad swath of the American East Coast, from New York to North Carolina.
Air quality alerts from Minneapolis all the way east to New York City, all the way down to the Carolinas tonight, in fact. Toxic smoke from the Canadian wildfires.
Dangerous air quality for millions of Americans. 13 states are on alert.
For those in the northeastern United States, it looks more like Mars outside than the planet Earth. Smoke has been traveling down from...
The wildfire smoke had us East Coasters feeling like the apocalypse had arrived. But fires aren't always doom and gloom. They can actually be restorative for forests.
Our forests have adapted to fire. If conditions are right, allowing that fire to burn, either natural fire, say from lightning, or sometimes human-caused fires, we can let those burn too, under controlled conditions, and if they are away from humans.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today on the show, Mapping Climate History. The New River Gorge in West Virginia recently became America's newest national park. Stockton Maxwell studies tree rings to chart forest fire history in Appalachia. He says for centuries, mining has been the root cause of many fires in the New River Gorge. Stockton is a professor of geospatial science at Radford University. Stockton, you grew up in West Virginia, which is known for its breathtaking wilderness areas. Did you spend a lot of time growing up in West Virginia forests?
Absolutely. A lot of my childhood was running around in the woods with my friends, riding mountain bikes, camping with my dad. And I grew up in Wheeling, West Virginia, along the Ohio River. And so I spent some time in the creeks and streams that flowed into the Ohio River. But now I work in southern West Virginia a lot near the New River, which is one of the oldest, most ancient rivers that we know of in the world. But West Virginia is dissected by hundreds of streams and rivers, each one of them rich with their own ecological and cultural history.
A lot of your current research centers on tree ring analysis. Tell me about tree ring analysis and some of the favorite things you find people learn from you about that work.
So tree ring analysis, or dendrochronology, is this field of science that helps us understand our past environmental history through studying characteristics of tree growth, like how wide the rings are that you might see. So for example, one of my recent projects is studying fire history, or how often fires have burned on the landscape. And what we can do is we can use those trees to help us understand how often fires occurred in the past when we didn't have human records of them. And so if you think about a tree, they're stuck on the landscape. They can't move when a fire comes. And so as the fire burns up to them, it heats up the cambium, or the outside growing portion of that tree, and it will kill those cells and injure them, but it may not kill the entire tree. And so that gives the tree an opportunity to callus over and grow some tissue to cover up that wound. And we can date that injury, and by looking at multiple trees in a forest, we can understand how often the fires have burned in that location.
Right now, you're focusing on fire history in Appalachia, especially West Virginia. How do fires there differ from fires on the West Coast?
Yeah, so what we found in the eastern United States is that fires were relatively frequent on every 5 to, say, 20 years. Some areas become more frequent, some areas less frequent, depending on the conditions and kind of the steepness of the terrain. But most of those fires in the eastern United States, they are typically because of how humans use the landscape and how we control the landscape with burning. We also just have cases where fires get out of control because maybe somebody was burning brush on their property or a campfire got out of control. And so the fires here in the eastern United States were relatively frequent, and they still are. But out in the western United States, it's a little bit of a different system because the forests out in the western United States are, on average, drier. And many of the fires there have a close relationship with climate and drought. And so the more drought we have out in the western United States, the more frequent fire becomes. And essentially, the relationship is that when a fire starts, it's more likely to spread because the fuels on the forest floor are drier. And so it's a little bit different because our forest ecosystems are different. How humans use the landscape is different between the East and the West.
What's the worst forest fire you've come across in looking at tree rings in West Virginia?
Actually, I think this is a really important thing, is that most fires are not too severe. And in a healthy ecosystem, most fires, if you actually ever see one of these in real life, the flames may be only up to your knee, maybe up to your thigh, and they're burning off the leaf litter and the branches that are on the forest floor. Occasionally, maybe they'll catch a dead tree on fire, but they're not the catastrophic fires that you may see on the news where every tree is burning all the way up through the canopy. And so most of the fires that I see are not really severe. They're actually low intensity fires that can be quite regenerative to the ecosystem. And so I actually wouldn't say there's many really challenging fires, except for when they come near human habitation. And then we need to make sure that we provide safety and guidance for that fire.
You've said that mining, especially in West Virginia, has led to a number of ignitions. I didn't realize that could happen. How does that work?
So in the New River Gorge, we know that mining had an extensive history starting back into the 1800s. And, you know, a lot of the things that we're doing, we are creating sparks by either the machinery that we have that may be in the forest and set a spark that could spread it, or in a lot of Appalachia, to move coal and timber, we have railroads. And while railroads are rather safe now, if we go back into the late 1800s, early 1900s with steam engines, more rudimentary track systems, sparks were quite common. And so you would have a fire that would be sparked from the railroad or some mining equipment. And in a steep terrain, that could move up the gorge pretty quickly. And so that's actually one of the sources of the fire ignitions that we see in the New River Gorge dating back into the 1800s.
Do you remember the excitement at Jamestown, Virginia, when tree rings were used to help identify a season of starving for the first settlers there?
Yeah, that was actually some research done by a colleague of mine, Dave Staley. And he was looking at some of the bald cypress trees growing in the swamps nearby Roanoke Island and Jamestown. And what he found was, unfortunately for the settlers, they were trying to build this brand new settlement during a period of rather intense drought. And so that was around the late 1500s, early 1600s, when they were beginning to settle. And that period ranks as one of the most intensive droughts, not just in the eastern United States, but that time period throughout North America was a very dry period, and not just for a single year, but for several years, creating some big challenges for people that were trying to build a new colony here. And that might have been one of the key factors that pushed the collapse of that settlement.
Have you ever been called into work similar to that, where you were asked as a dendrochronologist to help confirm or solve a mystery in history?
I've been working with some people recently where they are interested in the archaeological history of things like when cabins were built, because they want to know if the written history of these locations is actually confirmed by the tree ring evidence. So, for example, I'm working with a great group from Eastern Carolina University with a professor named Jason Raup and his student, Liv Livingston. And we are taking cores from submerged timbers in the Pamlico Tar River that would have been used to build a kind of a seawall around an island during a time period when they were beginning shipbuilding. And what we're trying to do is trying to confirm the dates of that construction so that we can better understand when human habitation was really taking hold in those regions. And the early evidence indicates that it's probably the late 1700s. But one of our challenges is we have to take tree cores underwater. And so we have a scuba diving team working to collect these samples. And this study is now ongoing. And so we have a team going back out in May when the weather warms up so that we can collect more samples and have better confirmation of these construction periods.
You know, I've never forgotten the person who told me when the colonists first arrived in the ships in the new land, they saw giant trees, tall, straight, towering trees, and delighted in seeing them, thinking these are going to be a great new source of masts for ships in Europe. Do you ever think about those times when there were vast stands of mostly virgin timber and mourn the loss?
I do, actually, because I love the natural world. It utterly fascinates me. The complexity of it, the relationships that we see between species, and just the aesthetic beauty of it. And so occasionally when you get that question kind of as an icebreaker, you know, if you could go back in time to any period, when would you go back to? I often think about before Europeans came to the United States, I would love to see what the forest looked like, because we know that Native Americans lived differently on the landscape and they weren't cutting down large portions of the forest. I would love to see those giant chestnut trees and giant oak trees and just marvel in the beauty of the forest. And then also, I mean, selfishly as a scientist, if I could go back and study it, then that would be amazing.
Do you ever encounter little secret stands of virgin timber now?
Yeah, actually, that's one of my favorite things to do as a tree ring scientist, because I like to reconstruct the history of the past several hundred to a couple thousand years. And to do that, we have to find these small pockets of old growth. And so maybe there's a landowner that you've talked to or a forester from the U.S. Forest Service or the Park Service. And they say, you know, I was walking out in the woods and I saw these trees and they looked like they had these big, thick limbs and they just looked like they had seen a lot in the world, you know. And so we will take tips and go out into those stands and collect samples to confirm whether or not that's the case, because sometimes big doesn't necessarily mean old. And so old growth, it doesn't always have a specific look. We often think big chunky bark, big thick limbs, maybe a twisted stem. But I've also worked in areas where old growth might look like almost like a bonsai tree. And so in the mountains of West Virginia, in the headwaters of the Potomac River, there are these old growth stands of eastern red cedar trees. And we didn't really know that they existed, but my professor had been paddling on that portion of the river. And she said, you know, Stockton, there's some trees up there that look like they're all twisted and gnarled. We should go up there and check it out. And so once we did, we saw these eastern red cedar trees, which is a really common species in the eastern U.S. They grow in farm fields. They grow on mountaintops. But in this location, they were growing on rock, limestone rock on the mountain. And nobody had touched them for hundreds of years. And so when we went to core the trees, we found that some of these trees were several hundred years old, including we cored the oldest living tree in West Virginia back in 2005. And at that time, it was over 730 years old. But the tree was only about 12 to 16 inches across and less than 20 feet tall. And it had just slowly grown cell by cell for centuries. And so old growth can take on a lot of different forms.
Stockton Maxwell, you have the coolest job of anyone.
I would agree. I'm pretty stoked to have made this a career.
Thanks for talking with me today and with good reason.
Thanks, Sarah. I appreciate it.
Stockton Maxwell is a professor of geospatial science at Radford University. Coral reefs are one of the most beautiful ecosystems of the natural world, and they're more than just a feast for the eyes. My next guest says reefs offer a map to the past, helping researchers track climate history over many hundreds of years. Pamela Groth is an earth and environmental sciences professor at the University of Mary Washington. Pamela, you study the coral reefs of Christmas Island. Where is it? What's it like?
So Christmas Island, it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and it's a very remote place. If you put a bullseye right in the middle of the Pacific, that's where this island is located. It's very remote that there's only one flight a week that gets you there from the weekly flight from Christmas Island to Fiji. It drops you off on the way to Fiji, and then 1 week later, you hope that it stops and picks you back up. true story, that one time that we did get stranded for a few days. Yeah, it's just such a unique little remote island that is very special to me.
When did you first go there?
My first trip was in 2013, and I was a new graduate student at the time. And it was actually, we were invited to go from the Years of Living Dangerously. So this was a documentary on climate change, and they were interested in filming our research on the coral reefs and climate change. So they funded this trip, and I got to go down there. And I've been down there at least 7 or 8 times since then.
Is it inhabited?
It is inhabited. It's got a small population of about 7,000 people. Mostly what happened was the Republic of Kiribati, their main island, Tarawa, got overpopulated. And so they needed a place to spread out. And so they moved some people over to this island. I would say that it's not an easy place to live. It actually has a dry climate. So there's very little rainfall. So small freshwater resources with one groundwater reservoir, a little bit of rain. The soil is really poor, so they can't grow any fresh food. They actually have really high diabetes rates because of all the processed food that has to be imported into there.
So you go there to study the coral reefs. They must be beautiful and virtually untouched.
The coral reefs are amazing. So I previously have only dove on reefs in the Caribbean, and I just was not prepared for what I was going to see the first time that I dove on the reefs on Christmas Island. Because the population is so small, because there's very little tourism, they're essentially untouched. To just dive into the water and see 100% coral cover all around, all living, healthy coral with lots of abundant fish swimming around. It was just a shock to me. And the Caribbean reefs, they're struggling because of the large population booms and tourism and overfishing and the coral disease. This island here, while it's not immune to all of those issues, it's definitely much more pristine because it doesn't see increased population and tourism that the Caribbean islands see.
I read that you can pretty much read the coral reef like a map. How do you do that? And what are you learning from it?
Yeah, the corals, they're so fascinating in how they act as temperature recorders in the water. So the corals, they build their skeletons out of these calcium carbonate. And as they're pulling the material from the water to make their skeleton, they incorporate that based off of the temperature. And we can measure the chemistry in their skeletons to give us a sense of what the temperature was at the time that they're growing. And if you plot a record of the water temperature with a record of the chemistry from the coral skeleton on top of each other, they are nearly identical. So that gives us a really good sense of how we can use these corals to extend what the temperature record was beyond the time that we had instruments actually measuring the temperature.
And these fluctuations in water temperature through the years, do they really matter to the coral? Do they hurt it, or they just reflect difference?
What we're mostly interested in is understanding bigger pictures of climate change from this region. So in the tropical Pacific is a huge driver for global climate change. It is the region for the El Nino events, and these El Nino events are events that are happening right in the tropical Pacific, where the tropical Pacific gets really warm. It causes these changes in the atmosphere that have global impacts. So during an El Nino event, Southern California usually has more rainfall and flooding events, whereas Southern Africa actually gets very dry and has droughts during those time periods. And so we go to this location is to try to understand the climate that's happening in this region because of those global consequences of rainfall patterns around the world. And so we can use the corals to go back farther in time to understand how the climate changes naturally. Because then if we know how the climate should behave naturally, and then we can see how the climate is behaving today with human-induced climate change, that helps us better understand the impact that we're having on the climate in this region, and also helps us then understand, well, how might that then impact these global climate patterns, since this region is such a driver for global precipitation changes.
Do El Niños almost always hurt the coral reefs?
We're seeing that more and more today, but not necessarily in the past. What we've seen is that during these El Niño events, generally speaking, the ocean gets warmer in many different regions, and it pushes the threshold, that temperature, too high for the corals, and they've bleached and they've died. We didn't always see this in the past because the baseline temperature, the ocean temperature, was cooler in the past. So even if you had these natural fluctuations like El Niño events that cause overall the temperature to get warmer, it would never make it hot enough so that they would get stressed and bleached and die until today. Now, because the baseline temperatures, the ocean water is already warmer from climate change, when you have these natural events like El Niño events, it just tips the scales just enough that it's causing the corals to bleach. I saw this firsthand in 2015 and 2016 on Christmas Island. This was one of the largest El Niño events on record. And we went down multiple trips each of those years to study the response of the corals during this time. And what we saw was about 80% of the coral reef bleached and died. We went back down in 2018, and it was one of the saddest things I'd ever seen. Just the dead coral and lots of macroalgae all around. And coral reefs, they will recover naturally, but it takes about a decade for them to recover. So we did just go back down there this past summer in 2023, and we did see that the reef has begun to recover, and so that's really good news. The problem, though, is that my research with these climate records, they actually show that these El Niño events are most likely intensifying, that meaning that these stronger El Niño events are happening more frequently. And if that's the case, then the amount of time between these El Niño events is going to get less, which means that the coral reefs are just not going to have enough time to recover between each of the events. And that's what scares me.
How old do you think the coral reefs around Christmas Island are? How far back do you think they go?
We currently can get records of climate from the coral reef back to about 6,000 years ago.
Isn't that remarkable?
It is. It's incredibly remarkable. It coincides with sea level change through history. So we exited a really cold glacial period when sea levels were really lower. And then by the time we got out of that and sea levels were higher and stable, that's when the reef was able to begin to flourish. And that was about 6,000 to 7,000 years ago.
We're on the verge of another potentially damaging El Niño this season, right?
We actually just exited an El Niño this past year. So we had an El Niño in 2023, so it peaks in the wintertime, and then in the springtime, it fizzles out. So we have just essentially exited it.
So an El Niño can be huge, like a hurricane can be huge and damaging, or it can be relatively minor.
Right. El Niño events happen every 2 to 7 years, but they vary in intensity. And by intensity, we mean by how warm the ocean water gets and the tropical Pacific region. And so the two biggest events that we've had were in 1997-98 and then in 2015 and 2016. And those had large warming of the ocean in the central tropical Pacific and the eastern tropical Pacific, had major devastations to precipitation patterns, causing floods and droughts in many regions, also caused massive global beaching events of the corals around the world. Luckily, this past year in 2023, it was a relatively mild event. We tried to get down in 2023 to do a baseline survey of the coral on Christmas Island to, one, we hadn't been down there since 2018 because of COVID. When COVID hit, Christmas Island shut down and nobody was allowed on or off the island for 3 years. So they had just opened back up their borders, and we got down there to get some understanding of how the reef had recovered. And it looks like it had recovered really well. And then some collaborators have been down there once more since this El Nino event. And luckily, it was not very bad, and they saw very little coral bleaching. So that's the good news.
You often take students with you to Christmas Island. That has to be so deeply affecting for them to do this research in one of the most beautiful underwater places in the world.
It is a once-in-a-lifetime experience for these students. You know, that's a little story. So this past summer when we went in 2023, it was actually a field expedition of a disaster. The country had just changed their research permitting, and our research permit was no longer valid when we got down there. And we were unaware of these changes. They literally happened like a day or two before we got down there. And so we were actually not able to do any research the entire week that we were there. But the students, they were just so excited and so positive despite all of these unexpected challenges, because just where they were. They just got this week of living and experiencing this remote island in the middle of nowhere and the culture of the people there. So it is truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience for these students.
It's so wonderful you can do that with them. I mean, if we're not taking students and scientists aren't getting this firsthand look, who will let us know what the big picture is and how we're changing the world around us, right?
That's right. Exactly.
Well, Pamela Groh, thank you so much for sharing your insights with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much for having me. Anytime I can talk about this, I'm happy to do so.
Pamela Groh is an Earth and Environmental Sciences professor at the University of Mary Washington. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. By now, most of us know about the harsh reality of sea level rise, but you might know less about the hazards of depleting our groundwater supply. Manuchehr Sherzai says groundwater overuse is causing coastal land to sink at an alarming rate, in some places close to 20 inches per year. Manuchehr is a geophysics and remote sensing professor at Virginia Tech. Manuchehr, you track California's sinking coastline using satellites. Why is it sinking?
So there are many different reasons for land to sink, and coastal lands are not exception. So we usually divide the drivers into two categories. So we say some of them are natural and some of them are human-made. So the most important one is removal of the fluids from the ground, whether it's water or oil and gas. So as a result of that extraction of the fluid, aquifers would compact, which manifests itself in land sinking on the surface.
How does excessive use of groundwater cause the land to sink?
You know, water is stored in empty spaces between grains. And as a result of that, land is stable as long as that water is staying where it is. So now when we extract the water, that empty spaces become again empty. Because of the weight of the sediment and soil on top of that, they begin to compact or close. And that closure of that empty spaces result into the land sinking on the surface and can be very fast. So we have example of the land sinking rate, for example, in Central Valley in California, that is as high as 40 centimeters per year.
What is that in inches?
Oh, that's a good question. So 1 inch would be 2.5 centimeters. So it's almost 20 inches. We are looking at about 16, 17 inches per year.
Oh, gosh, 20 inches per year. I can't imagine that. That's almost 2 feet. So if you're looking from above and you are watching it in time lapse, let's say, what would you see happening with that sinking?
So some part of the land are sinking so fast that it creates a bowl into the ground. So that bowl, for example, can be flooded, create a tiny lake, sometimes big, depending on the amount of precipitation. And that lake can last for a while. This can impact the infrastructure. So for example, any linear infrastructure, railways, pipeline, can be damaged because of that. Also, foundation of the buildings can be weakened and eventually cause the failure of the building. So the consequences are immense, and it can cost a lot in over the long period of time. I'm talking about a decade or two.
So in California, what was causing most of the groundwater extraction? Was this just people showering and doing their laundry loads and drinking water, or was it industry?
Right. So industry and agriculture are the biggest user of the groundwater in California, by far. There are some industry that extract large volume of the water, but we don't quite know which industry is the biggest player or how much they extract, because there is no regulation, or there are very few regulation to require actors to report their water use. So we have guesses, but the data is very sparse when it comes to who is using how much.
Where else are you seeing this in the U.S., where states are impacted from groundwater depletion and sinking coasts?
So this problem, unfortunately, is very widespread. So almost everywhere in the country we see that. You know, in Southwest Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico have that problem. But other places, Texas, Florida, Virginia. And often groundwater use is not tied to the climate change, really, because groundwater is accessible source of fresh water, often very easy to be accessed, not heavily regulated in contrast to, for example, surface water. So it's a to-go source for many industries and many people around the country.
Which city has it worst?
Some of the fastest sinking cities in the United States include Phoenix, Arizona, where we detect subsidence rates as fast as a few inches per year in some location. And also, as a result of this sinking, we see, for example, cracks and extensional fissures developing across the area. Some of the buildings are even affected by that, and some of the infrastructure. Along the Gulf Coast, New Orleans is by far the worst situation. So entire city is subsiding at a fast rate of up to an inch. And that makes the entire city vulnerable to flooding due to the sea level rise. And then when we continue our journey toward the East Coast, we see that some part of the East Coast, such as Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, stands out in terms of hotspots of land subsidence. Some places in Chesapeake Bay subside at the rate of about 5 to 7 millimeters per year. For example, we see sunny day flooding across the Hampton Road that is tied to the rising sea level, but also land sinking. Also, during the storms, large part of the area get flooded due to the lowering of the elevation of the land as a result of that land sinking.
Are there any links between depleting the groundwater and smaller earthquakes?
When we change the volume of the groundwater in aquifers, we can trigger or induce earthquakes on adjacent faults. My lab, for example, has studied the link between fluid pressure change and induced seismicity in Midwest U.S., like Oklahoma and Texas, for years. So we know that exists. However, the observations are scarce too. You know, we need a certain condition for earthquake to be triggered or induced by change in the volume of the groundwater. And those conditions don't exist everywhere. But the short answer is yes, there is a possibility of triggering earthquake when we change the volume of the groundwater.
Do you feel we should be taking steps in coastal communities to ensure groundwater levels are healthier and replenished?
Definitely, because when we extract groundwater, salt water intrudes into them and reduces the quality of the water. So we have multiple hazards associated with the extraction of the groundwater, particularly along the coast. So to mitigate those hazards, we need to replenish aquifers. And this process has to be managed. So we cannot really wait for the natural recharge process because they are slow. And the rate that we depleted aquifers, we need similar rate of replenishment as well.
What would it take? And how many years to use other sources of water?
So the process of replenishing groundwater can be fairly quick. So depending on infrastructures and investments, it can be done in a matter of months to years. So the good example of that is Santa Ana Water District in south of LA in California. They established their water treatment and recharge facilities a couple of years ago and expanded that rapidly. And now they have one of the most advanced recharge facilities in the world. Through that recharge facility are replenishing aquifer system in Orange County. And regardless of the drought condition, aquifers are always in a healthy condition.
What did it take for them to do that? Was it a lot of money, a lot of forbearance about stealing the water from the ground?
So this process requires significant investment upfront. So we have to build infrastructures, and they are not cheap. But in long term, in long run, storing water under the ground has many different advantages that it's totally worth the initial investment. So, you know, comparing the aquifers with, for example, a surface reservoir, a dam. Dams are a lot more expensive. Roughly 10 times a dam project would be more expensive than a managed aquifer recharge project. But dams have unintended environmental consequences. They are always associated with hazard. If the dam breached or overtopped, it can cause flooding. Also, surface reservoirs are exposed to contamination and evaporation. Groundwater often is not exposed to contamination and evaporation problem is not existing there. So water that we put under the ground can be used years later, and through the time, it increases in its purity and quality, while the surface water needs still to be treated and so on. So overall, given the broad benefit of underground storage of the water, a managed aquifer recharge project, despite initial cost, is by far most economic and beneficial solution to store water compared to the surface reservoirs behind the dam.
I wonder if you've communicated with the EPA and with national lawmakers about what you'd like to see happen with groundwater?
You know, as much as we hope to get engaged with EPA and other decision makers at national and local level, we haven't been successful much just because we don't know how to reach them. So, you know, people like yourself, reporters, I think they are able to bridge the gap between scientific community that produce the knowledge and the decision maker that ultimately try to implement that knowledge in a way that help everybody. So, yeah, the short answer is no, we haven't been really successful in reaching decision makers, but I'm hoping that it changes in future.
I hope so, too. Thank you for sharing your insights with me on With Good Reason.
Oh, thank you so much for talking to me. It was my pleasure.
Manucha Sherzai is a geophysics and remote sensing professor at Virginia Tech. The Equity Center at the University of Virginia empowers communities to tackle climate injustice head-on. Barbara Brown Wilson is a co-founder of the Equity Center. She shares some of her favorite projects across Virginia, from heat islands in Charlottesville to coastal flooding on the Eastern Shore in the Chesapeake Bay. Barbara is an urban and environmental planning professor at the University of Virginia. Barbara, your research focus has been on environmental and urban planning. What's the difference between those two, and why both?
Well, the UVA Department of Urban and Environmental Planning that I'm a part of is one of the only departments in the country that has both together. And the both was because they are intertwined, and we are a part of the environment. We are part of nature, and so are cities. Next to the Chicago Zoo, there's this really great sort of lakish thing that's a beautiful public park. You wouldn't know it, but Studio Gang Architects had actually designed this boardwalk so people can, the Chicago Public Zoo is free. You want to see the animals, you want to take a break, you also get to walk on a beautiful boardwalk. And then they also designed a series of material choices for the boardwalk that would make sure that all of the environment and, you know, and non-human actors living in the water down below would be happy too. So it's really beautiful things like that where everybody is happier because they're all elevated in how they live.
You know, we all want to live in nature, be shielded from it, but also revel in it, right? I live not far from a river, and for years you couldn't access the river because the paths to it were so thick and gnarled and tangly. And one day, the community created a river walk, and it has immeasurably added to the joy and the ability to get into nature.
Mm-hmm.
Is that environmental or urban planning?
The whole point is you don't have to choose. You know, I love that river walk, and my kids can swing into the river from the tree nearby, and I can run with my friend on the pathway, and my dog can be in the landscape. But also, that's a place where lots of really important environmental things are happening, and there's habitat there where a lot of creatures are living, and we get to have biodiversity that kind of keeps us all healthy. So it's yes, yes to both.
How does all this come into your co-creation of something called the Equity Center at the University of Virginia where you work? What does the Equity Center do?
The Equity Center is a place that was founded really through community brilliance. We have a lot of amazing people in the Charlottesville, Albemarle area who for a long time have felt left out by our major employer, our major healthcare provider, our major landowner, that is the University of Virginia, and instead wanted to be in charge of creating their own knowledge and being a part of making for an equitable place. Charlottesville is one of the, at least in 2015, was one of the lowest places in the country, bottom 3% for places where you could build wealth if you were poor. And we wanted to make that different. And we felt like UVA needed to have a role in that, but it needed to not be driving things. And so there's a whole bunch of people involved, and people know how to make good decisions for themselves. So giving the platform for collective decision making was really the goal.
What about climate justice? That's one of the main goals the Equity Center is trying to really facilitate around the state. What does that look like? What is climate justice?
Climate justice is the recognition that extreme climate events are happening more and more. Our weather is getting weirder, and our low-income communities shouldn't have to bear a higher burden of the weight of that change.
And why do we say lower-income people suffer any more than high-income people? Climate's climate, right?
Well, so often because of urban planners like myself and the way that we've developed in the United States, low-income people weren't given the choice on where they could live. And so they were having to build in the lowlands. And a lot of public housing was being created in the lowlands. And then those are also the places where redlining allowed for only white neighborhoods to really build wealth. And also lower-income neighborhoods were not given access to things like trees. So you see there's still a lack of shade in lower-income communities. And that's a big deal when public housing residents don't have HVAC units in Charlottesville. So we work with a lot of young teenagers who are really hot in the middle of the summer. And that's not fun. It's not fun to be really hot with nowhere to go. And if you have a system that has set up where poor people don't get shade, that's a climate injustice. On the Eastern Shore, we do a lot of work where the Environmental Institute at UVA has been working for a long time. They have a coastal research center there, but they hadn't really been working on issues that resonated for the Black community of the Eastern Shore and for the migrant communities that work there. And they wanted the Equity Center to come help them figure out how to make things more relevant to the people of the Eastern Shore.
Tell us about the Eastern Shore, what it's like and who does live there.
Yeah, so the Eastern Shore is two counties that are a little bit, they're on a peninsula that's more connected to Maryland than it is to Virginia otherwise, but it's pretty isolated economically, and they have a lot of flooding happening and a lot of salt water coming into their agricultural lands, which is not good for growing things. So one of the wonderful people we work with on that project, Andre Elliott, is the executive director of the YMCA there, one of the anchor institutions on the Eastern Shore. And he was like, well, I care about climate justice because I know that when any kid can't get picked up by a bus for the school system, the whole school's closed. So every time any road is flooded on the Eastern Shore, every child is affected. And, you know, so these are the sorts of things that matter to that community is how are the elderly people getting access to the medical care they need when sometimes the road's washing out and services can't get to them.
What can you do for them? I mean, you can't stop the waters from rising.
We are hoping to make a climate equity atlas that allows people to make good decisions, not only at the local government level, but at the state government, so that they can put resources towards the things that matter to the people of the Eastern Shore. So a lot of the work we do is just bringing people together. The head of the Chamber of Commerce is on our community advisory committee, the head of both school districts, the head of the health district, pastors, you know, other types of community leaders that are helping us understand what people on the Eastern Shore care about so that then we can give them a decision support tool where they can talk across difference. So we won't be the saviors that come in with any big solution, but we hope to be a part of having a really rich conversation about what people care about and how to make decisions that align with those values.
Let me go back to Charlottesville and the University of Virginia. Are there small examples of how the Equity Center and local community leaders have worked together to make just one spot a little better?
There's so many beautiful projects on the site that was called Friendship Court and is now Kindlewood, which is a community of 150 families, low-income families living in subsidized housing that was built in the late 60s, early 70s. And it was time for kind of an adjustment, a redevelopment. It was switching ownership. And a local group wanted it to be a resident-driven redevelopment. So we were helping with that. And the university was able to get funding that started a youth program. And that youth program allowed for young people living at Friendship Court to be part of the design team. And they said, we want to work on playgrounds. And they would say things like, well, the mulch gives you ringworm, so we don't want mulch anymore. We want a different type of flooring. And so they would conduct their own surveys. They would make posters. I went and got them chicken, you know, at the place they thought where the chicken should come from. And then
food is good.
Food is always good. And then they held an event where they asked other teens and younger children, because they realized, oh, we need to, we're not the only ones here that should have a say, exactly what they wanted to see. And then they worked, actually, UVA Facilities has an apprenticeship program. And so between Piedmont Housing Alliance staff and UVA Facilities apprenticeship and local teens, there was a new beautiful playground that was also kind of a prototype for what they wanted to see being built in the future. And yeah, so lots of little projects. There's a thing called Seville Tulips that another co-founder of the Equity Center, Bonnie Gordon, has helped to create, where she just saw that there were a bunch of new community members from Afghanistan that were moms and with kids who were often kind of feeling like they had to stay at home. They didn't have driver's licenses. They didn't have a way to kind of feel free in the community and didn't have rich connections. And so every Sunday now they meet and they want to learn language skills. They want to learn about kind of maternal health. And then they want their kids to be able to play together and build a new community that has ties back to Afghanistan, but also, you know, is a part of the rich fabric that is Charlottesville now. So there's a ton of wonderful little things where the community that came together with the Equity Center is doing magical, magical stuff.
When do you think there was a kind of sea change in how we look at all these things? Was there a moment where we began to be drawn to really seriously looking at climate justice and equity in our communities and that kind of thing? Was there something that launched us?
Mm. It feels like in each community, there was a moment where you felt it. You felt the change and, oh my God, these storms are coming more often. The wildfires from up north are making it so my kid can't play outside in the summer. You know, these various ways that our daily lives and the things we hold dear have been challenged. My mother grew up in Pensacola, Florida, and still lives in her mother's old house there today. And I worry about, you know, her every time a hurricane comes through. So I think everybody has a version of that. Like, there was an earthquake this morning in New Jersey, and that's weird. So I now teach a climate justice class. When I was in school, there was no class on climate justice.
Exactly, right?
But they care. Those students care a lot.
Barbara Brown Wilson, this has been such a delight. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Barbara Brown Wilson is an urban and environmental planning professor at the University of Virginia. She's also the co-founder of UVA's Equity Lab. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Aviva Costo and Andrew Rice are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast or to comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.